as is often my way, I'd like to begin my remarks with an apology, specifically to Molly, but also to all of you, and frankly, to the United States. So when Molly and I were colleagues at the Federalist, I was best known for my really awful predictions. There was the column that I wrote titled, "Anthony Scaramucci is the man that Trump and America needs." 3 hours after that column ran, he was fired. Not long after, I wrote a column about how the New York City mafia really isn't very violent anymore. Later that day, the head of the Gambino family was assassinated. So you get, basically, if there's anything you want to have happen in the world, get me to write a column saying it won't. And so about this time last year, the Federalist sent myself and Chris Bedford, a wonderful reporter, out to Pennsylvania to take the temperature, see how the voters were doing, right? Filed some pieces, came back, I'm back in New York, and I did a Fox News hit. And talking about it, it wasn't even summoned, I wasn't even asked, and I just kind of blurted out, "I can't see any way Trump loses Pennsylvania." I step out of the studio van, I pick up my phone, and there's an email from Molly, not just to me, but to the entire Federalist staff. Subject line, "WTF, Marcus." At the body of the email, I'll have to paraphrase, but I think it said something like, "You just lost the election." So if there's no Christmas presents this year, I apologize. That might have been my fault. I want to hone in on Molly's point about Jefferson, right? I write for the New York Post. Molly created something that we might think of as the Jeffersonian paradox, right? Like, we have to have the free press, or else this whole thing that he figured out with his buddies, Adams, and everybody else isn't going to work. On the other hand, the people involved in the free press are a bunch of reckless liars. So how do you balance these two ideas? I think for us it's harder than it would have been for Jefferson for reasons that Molly laid out, which is that Jefferson had no expectation of a straight down the line objective press. In 1801, when Alexander Hamilton and his buddies got together to create the New York Post, they were doing it basically for one reason, which was to drag Thomas Jefferson. Right? That's why you got the Hunter Biden laptop story, right? It goes that far back. And there were plenty of papers at the time that existed to prop Thomas Jefferson up. And we all knew what the game was, right? And it was a fair game. You get to the beginning of the 20th century, and I don't have time to go into why I think this happened, but let's just say the conglomeration of the media, right? Radio, the movies, television. All of a sudden, you get gatekeepers, right? These gatekeepers could really tell the narrative, and they created a whole bunch of rules, right? And the man who follows me is a journalism professor. I didn't go to journalism school, but these rules exist, right? One of the big ones is what we call church and state. And that has to do with the straight news side versus the opinion side. Now, I'm not a big fan of the division of church and state, even when it comes to government, much less so when it comes to journalism. But we had this notion, right? And we said, well, there's this side and there's this side. And in 1994, if you watched the McLaughlin Group, what did you see? You saw some opiners from the Baltimore Sun or the Philadelphia Inquirer, right? The key is that these gatekeepers controlled both. They controlled the straight news. They controlled the opinion. That created the narrative. You get to the 21st century. Now you have the internet. Now you have the blogosphere, right? Blogosphere couldn't compete with the legacy outlets on straight news. Straight news is a high bar, requires a lot of resources, right? You need bureaus, you need travel expenses, you need, you know, all kinds of things that, like, nobody's ever really given me. But, like, it's expensive, right? The opinion side. Oh, you got a laptop? You got an internet connection? You got chops? Game on. Game on. You can fight the New York Times. You can beat them. And a lot of people did, right? So the legacy media says, ugh, okay, we're losing the opinion side. What do we do? You notice in about 2004, 2005, there starts to be a new kind of news story in the front side of the paper. We call it the front side of the paper, right? Call it news analysis. Well, what is this? What is news analysis? It started with issues like climate change, where editors at places like the New York Times, CNN, these other places, they said, you know, we can't do this both sides thing anymore, right? Because we know that climate change is real. So it's irresponsible of us to just say the Democrats said this, the Republican said that. We need to be able to provide more context for our readers to be responsible, right? And they started to do that. The way they started to do that was they said, we'll bring in expert opinions. I want all of you, I'll give you an assignment. All of you, over the next 2 weeks, it'll only take 2 weeks, notice every time you look at a headline from the New York Times or the Washington Post, and it says, Republicans say X, experts disagree. Not Democrats disagree, experts disagree, right? And this was really a way to bring opinion into the news side. This is really what they were doing. It was subtle, it was marginal, not a huge deal, okay. Then there's the golden escalator. Then there's Donald Trump. And as Molly points out, suddenly the media decides we can't treat him the way we've treated every other president. I was, 2019, Ben Domenech, the publisher of The Federalist, he sends me, CNN does this thing once a year where they congratulate themselves and there's like hors d'oeuvres and stuff. I think I was being punished. But he sends me, and Brian Stelter, their media guy, right, is interviewing Jeff Zucker, the boss. And it was absolutely insufferable. I'm interviewing the boss. I better be careful. It's horrible. It's a horrible experience. You know, but there was a moment where they were discussing whether it was okay to show a speech by the President of the United States. Thankfully, I guess, they agreed that it was, right? They said, yes, okay, we have to show a speech by the President of the United States. But maybe we need to fact check it in live time. Maybe we need a cryon down at the bottom. Here's where he's lying. Here's where he's... The point is, once again, the rules changed. A little more drastically this time. Then March of 2020, and a virus arrives from China. Now, it's not just an esoteric philosophical question for journalism professors about what is the proper role of context in straight news reporting. It's not just the fear that Donald Trump is going to destroy democracy. Now, if we tell Americans the unfiltered truth about what the actual death rate from COVID is, we're going to get people killed. People are going to die. So what did the media do? They lied. They lied a lot. And they lied very specifically in order to make you behave the way that experts really thought you needed to, or else people were going to die, right? That's a reasonable fear. I did it, right? I remember conversations at the Federalist in the very early days of COVID when we had doubts about these lockdowns. And it was, oh, do we run a piece saying maybe we're going too far here in New York City? I was worried about it, right? I didn't want to downplay what was a very serious virus. I had real serious concerns. What was my ethical responsibility as a journalist facing this moment? And in the early days, I made the wrong choice. You know, and I admit that, and I admit that in my book. I made the wrong choice. I decided that I shouldn't be honest with my readers about what I was thinking. And in retrospect, I realized I was treating them like children, and I'll never make that mistake again. But that is what the media does. That is what the news media does. And so, just to wrap up, you think, like, what's the answer? How do we go forward, right? A shibboleth among conservatives is, oh, we have so many columnists, we don't have enough reporters, right? We need more reporters. We need to do straight news. There's no more straight news, folks. There isn't. It's not coming back. It was a myth. It was always a myth. And here there may be some disagreement with my pals. I don't think it ever was the golden age of Walter Cronkite. Those people weren't telling you the truth. What we need to do now, and what I think we are doing, is to do exactly what the New York Times did on the straight news side by bringing more opinion into the straight news side, to bring more straight news into the opinion side. And we're already seeing it happen, right? Who's the journalist this year who's probably had the biggest impact on the country? Chris Rufo, right? Chris is a friend of mine. He's fantastic. And Chris doesn't write straight news. Chris writes opinion pieces in the New York Post, and he writes for the Manhattan Institute and City Journal. He breaks a lot of news, right? We didn't know all these woke corporations were making their employees profess their white privilege, right? Chris showed us that. He showed it to us on the opinion side, though, right? His job is to be persuasive. It might not be surprising that I land here as an answer, my background in journalism being at the Federalist, because Molly does this every day. Joy Pullman files FOIA reports, right, and teaches us about the education system. Margot Cleveland, right, finds out about Russian collusion. John Davidson goes down to the border to write these opinion pieces about the border, right? Chris Bedford sacrifices himself at late-night cocktail parties in D.C. so that we can all know the ins and outs, right? Selena Zito, and I'll close with this. Selena Zito is my favorite, and she's become a friend of mine, and I model a lot of my work after Selena. 2015, 2016, there were all these people in the middle of the country going to vote for Trump. I said, these people are crazy. But why? Why would they do it? It's got to be white grievance. It's got to be economic anxiety. There's got to be some answer. So Selena decided, why don't I get in my car and go drive and talk to these people and ask them. And she did. And they told her that the coastal elites don't listen to us. They don't care about us. And frankly, they're doing us harm. Selena reported this. What happened? Even on the right, you remember this, right? Even on the right, they called her a liar. They said, you're making this up. You never met that guy at the gas station. You never spoke to that person at the diner. You just made this up. 2 years later, I revisited her trip. These people told me the exact same thing because Selena was telling the truth. For me, this is called the future of journalism. That's what we're talking about. The future of journalism is a combative journalism. I have my side. You have your side. Let's go at it. Let's tell the truth as we know it, as we believe it, and let's leave aside this childish notion that the New York Times or the Washington Post or, God forbid, CNN is giving you anything even remotely like objective straight news.